I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last Friday, the Justice Department and the Department of Education sent a joint letter to the nation's public schools telling them they must allow transgender students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms that match their gender identity. Last week, the federal government also sued North Carolina over its bathroom bill that people must use the bathroom that matches their birth certificate. Here's Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
This action is about a great deal more than bathrooms. This is about the dignity and the respect that we accord our fellow citizens and the laws that we as a people and as a country have enacted to protect them, indeed to protect all of us. And it's about the founding ideals that have led this country, haltingly but inexorably, in the direction of fairness, inclusion, and equality for all Americans.
The critical response to the Obama administration's letter to schools was quick, and one of the most outspoken was Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Here he is referring to President Obama.
He says he's going to withhold funding if schools do not follow the policy. Well, in Texas, he can keep his 30 pieces of silver. We will not yield to blackmail from the President of the United States. And let me point out something. The schools in Texas get about $10 billion over our two-year budget of federal funds. A majority of that is for free breakfast and free lunch through the food program, through the Ag Department. So Barack Obama, if schools don't knuckle down to force girls showering with boys and force 8-year-old girls to have to endure boys coming into their bathroom, he's taking money from the poorest of the poor.
The Obama administration did say that states or districts that did not follow the directive could or would face the loss of federal funds. We begin our conversation with Matt Apuzzo. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. He's been covering justice and this issue. And Matt Apuzzo, nice to have you with us on the show.
Great to be here.
So what was the Obama administration referring to or responding to, I should say, when they sent out this letter on Friday?
Well, I mean, this is something that's been in the works for a long time. I mean, many months this letter's been in the works. Part of it is this is kind of a progression for the Obama administration in terms of its views that, transgender rights kind of fit into the sort of larger policy of gay and lesbian rights that the administration has really been pushing for the past 7 years. I mean, you know, we saw where the Justice Department wouldn't back the Defense of Marriage Act. You know, the administration obviously supported gays serving openly in the military. The administration banned discrimination by federal contractors. This is really just a progression of a policy, and what the Obama administration would say was, in a lot of ways, this letter was responding to questions that the schools had themselves. Well, what should we be doing? What are best practices? So, on the one hand, it is part of a larger policy. On the other hand, it's them responding to questions the schools had.
In fact, I'm looking at the letter that was sent out. There are things like terminology, identification documents, I mean, of some very sort of specific guidelines for schools, terminology being a very interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, I mean, it's a long letter, and it comes with 25 pages of best practices that the Justice Department and the Education Department consider to be kind of the best practices for schools, and many of them are already implemented in schools nationwide. So, I mean, I think what the administration would say was this isn't a dramatic overhaul of current policy. Obviously this isn't something that's going to dramatically change for, you know, the vast majority of students. But it is something that they wanted to put in writing. I mean, it's the last year of the administration. I think there is a sense that they can do, you know, that they can make a difference for transgender students and transgender people in general by codifying this in a big way.
I don't know if it's a backlash exactly, but we did play Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. Others have criticized this directive coming from the administration. Did they, do you think, expect that kind of pushback?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, look, the North Carolina law, you know, HB 2 that went into effect, that, you know, among other things, you know, had a, you know, had a provision that said bathrooms can only be used by, you know, be limited to people whose sex, you know, at birth matches the, you know, the label on the bathroom. You know, there was obviously a backlash when the administration at first sort of threatened to withhold funding, and then ultimately when both sides sued each other. So I don't think there was any surprise that there was going to be criticism. I think the administration feels like it has the law on its side. And to be clear, this is unsettled law. Right. I mean, what we're talking about is a civil rights law that protects, that forbids sex discrimination. The administration is saying gender identity is covered under sex discrimination laws. That is an unsettled, you know, matter of law. But there was an opinion in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia recently that that sided with the Justice Department's view of things. So I think that, you know, yes, the administration expected backlash, but I think they feel like they are they're ultimately going to prevail on this in the courts, and they're probably ultimately going to prevail on it in the court of public opinion. So I don't think they were caught by surprise by any of the, of the criticism.
When you say it's unsettled law, the question is whether transgender people, I guess, what, qualify under Title IX or sex discrimination
right.
laws?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Title IX says you can't discriminate against anybody for gender reasons. You know, for there can't be sex discrimination. If you're receiving federal education money, you can't have sex discrimination. And the administration's view is transgender students are covered by that. And, you know, the question of whether gender identity is the same as sex is not just semantics. Obviously, it has very real consequences for a lot of transgender students. So that's something that's ultimately going to probably be settled by courts. And, you know, the like I said, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia sided with the government's view on this. But there will be other challenges for sure.
Meaning that it probably or might make its way to the U.S. Supreme Court for a final determination?
Well, I mean, everything probably will get there, whether, you know, they would take it or not. I mean, I think depends on, you know, whether another appeals court somewhere else in the country takes a different view on this. Probably will depend on who the next Supreme Court justice is, whether we stay with an 4-4 split in the courts. You know, there's a lot of moving parts here. But I think, you know, both the Justice Department and the Education Department feel like, and the White House feel like, the law is ultimately on their side, and that they'll probably prevail. So I don't think they're too hung up on the criticism.
And I'm curious about whether the administration, either the Justice Department or the Education Department, if a district or even a state, as we heard from the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, decides not to follow this directive, what recourse, I guess, does the federal government have? I mean, there is this threat of withholding money. We heard the lieutenant governor saying you're going to do this on the backs of poor people because that's where most of the money comes to pay for things like school lunch programs.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of steps. There are a lot of steps in the along the way before that happens. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, one school decides to do something else and, you know, Washington just turns off the spigot. I mean, there's a lot of steps that can, you know, discussions, mediation, lawsuits that can happen before that happens. I think what you know, folks in Washington would say about this isn't in the end, you know, something that is some sweeping policy that's, you know, that's going to change overnight. In a lot of ways, this is something that schools are already dealing with. This is something that a lot of schools have already dealt with very quietly and, you know, without a lot of fanfare. And that for the most part, teachers and principals want to deal with this without making, pardon the pun, a federal case out of it.
Sure.
So I don't know. I don't know if this is going to, if there's going to be a rash of cases in Texas of principals saying we're not going to do this. You know, obviously that'll remain to be seen. But I think for the most part, parents, students, and principals probably want to resolve this discreetly.
Well, and probably those districts, families, parents, schools that do want to resolve this discreetly, they're not going to get the same kind of coverage as those people who are so outspoken about these bathroom bills.
Right, and that's what we heard a lot of from administrators after our story ran. We, you know, in a lot of cases, they said, look, you know, we've already been dealing with this. You know, we didn't put out a press release. We already put in policies that resolve this rather easily, like, you know, having stalls in the bathroom, privacy stalls, you know, having a privacy curtain that people can change behind. You know, it's not a matter of, you know, everybody's now required to walk around naked in the bathroom. I mean, you know, I think that for a lot of principals and administrators, this was something that could be worked out without a lot of drama. Well, but obviously, people feel strongly about this. I mean, on both sides.
Absolutely.
I think that's why it gets attention.
And we've got a lot of comments that are coming in, and we'll probably pick them up when our other two guests join the conversation. This goes back to North Carolina, HB2, when we're seeing a number of pretty large corporations talking about boycotts, putting kind of financial pressure on the government there. Do you think that will maybe be more effective than the lawsuit track?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not an expert on North Carolina politics by any stretch. I mean, the first I heard of HB2 was when it passed and got some news attention. So North Carolina politics is a little out of my lane, but certainly, you know, in this day and age, you know, the financial pressure that comes from these sorts of movements is very real and something that, you know, the state's going to certainly have to deal with politically, if not legally.
Well, Matt, we're almost out of time. We're going to be talking about the civil rights movements associated with bathrooms. You cover justice. Are you surprised that you're now covering bathrooms?
I'm a little surprised I'm not covering bathrooms. But, you know, look, I think I've covered civil rights, you know, through Washington for a while now. And I think folks at the Justice Department and the Obama administration would say, yeah, I mean, you could cover racial discrimination in the civil rights era, and you were covering bathrooms.
Right.
So in that regard, I think, you know, they see this as a continuation of that effort, desegregating bathrooms back in the civil rights era.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Matt Apuzzo, for joining us on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent, works in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, covers justice, and has been covering some of these bathroom bills. We're going to take a very short break. We've got two guests, waiting in the wings, and we are talking about civil rights and bathrooms. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about the directive sent last week by the Obama administration to the nation's public schools about bathrooms and transgender students. This comes shortly after North Carolina passed a law that people in the state must use the bathroom that corresponds to the sex on their birth certificate. Now, this is not the first time that there has been a battle over bathrooms and civil rights. We have two more guests who have joined us. Samantha Michaels is copy editor at Mother Jones, has reported on the recent bathroom-related legislation as well as a history of toilets over the centuries. And Samantha Michaels, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And I should say, joining us by Skype. Also with us is Harvey Mollich, a professor of sociology and metropolitan studies at New York University, wrote a book a couple of years ago titled Toilet, Public Restrooms and the Politics of Sharing. Harvey Mollich, nice to have you with us on the show as well.
Good to be with you.
Harvey, let me begin with you. Your book came out about 5 years ago. Why do you think this issue taps into such a an emotional response. And we certainly have heard that over the last few days.
So I think that public restrooms are a kind of catch-all for anxiety. They're a remarkable thing because people are doing the most private, intimate acts in a public space. And that really sets it up for people to take anxieties into that place and create public issues that are difficult to get past.
And anxiety because, I mean, I don't have to tell people how they go to the bathroom, but the fact that they're, you know, near naked, they're doing something very private in front of people that are mostly strangers, Harvey?
Yes, and not necessarily in front, but of course through sound and other senses, you're exposed in ways that ordinarily you take great precautions to never have such exposure, and there it's going on. So that means that there's great anxiety not only about what you're doing, but what other people might be doing in this place. And there's a constant sort of history of trying to balance it out. How much should people be assured total privacy, or should there be mechanisms to not have that privacy, to engage in public surveillance of what's going on in this public place? There's the dilemma.
Indeed. And I do want to pick up on that. Samantha, let me get you in on the conversation. There's been largely focus on North Carolina and, of course, the directive sent out last Friday by the Obama administration. Are other states doing similar things about their bathrooms?
Well, other states have certainly been considering similar bathroom bills this year. I believe something like 15 other states besides North Carolina have been considering bills. They haven't passed the bills or enacted them, but have been considering bills that are similar, that restrict access to bathrooms according to birth sex.
To what is on someone's birth certificate?
Yes, in some cases, it's according to what's on a person's birth certificate. In some cases, the bills use slightly different language, referring to chromosomes. But in all cases, it's basically a matter of what gender you are assigned at birth.
And where do you think these bills are coming from, Samantha? I mean, what is behind this?
Well, some observers have pointed to a conservative backlash in the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision last summer that legalized gay marriage. And others have pointed to things like growing visibility of transgender people in pop culture and in the media, and then a backlash to that. But there have also been some big conservative groups that have really been pushing this bathroom issue and pushing for restricted access. And there are a number of groups that have been supporting this, but there's one in particular that I've been looking at that seems to have had real particular influence. And that group is called the Alliance Defending Freedom. The Alliance Defending Freedom is a network of lawyers, more than 3,000 allied lawyers. They're based in Arizona, but they have offices all over the world. And they fight for religious freedom, often in courts. And starting back in 2014, this group sent out letters to school districts across the country urging schools to create policies that would restrict bathroom access according to sex at birth. And the Alliance Defending Freedom also started sending out model legislation to legislators, state legislators across the country, urging similar policies either at schools or in public buildings. And we've seen in some of the bathroom bills that have been proposed in different states that legislators have actually taken the Alliance Defending Freedom's model legislation and in some cases copied it word for word or used very, very similar language while drafting their own bills.
Let me get you back in on the conversation, Harvey. And I'm thinking about some of the language. Ted Cruz talked about grown men using the little girl's room. We certainly have heard that from others who have criticized these bills. How effective do you think that language is?
Well, the whole thing is putting a sign up in a room and identifying it as women and thereby preventing, for example, rape it has always been a fiction. I'm almost speechless with it because it's a problem that doesn't exist. And in the sense of the crude man or the crude boy going into the girls' room, I think that what the background feature of this, and you sort of brought it up in your last comments, is the great anxiety about the mixing of the genders and threatening gender segregation, not only in terms of physical space, but keeping the lines pure, that boys are boys and girls are girls and never the twain shall meet. And gay liberation, women's liberation, women entering into men's jobs, I see it as all of a piece. And so here we have, in a way, the last bastion of gender segregation, and that is the public restroom. And the fact that some people are intersexed, are trans, or gay, starts threatening that whole structure, and I think creates a kind of general anxiety that now this issue, it comes to hold all of that anxiety.
Well, and it's hard not to think about the racial segregation for things like bathrooms and for water fountains, Harvey, of not so long ago. Do you see parallels there?
Oh, indeed. And in just the way that black people were held to be essentially different than white people, and that a threat, an intense threat to that fiction of essential difference was the engaging in intimacy, shared intimacy, in things like public restrooms or swimming pools. That was the other hot spot of segregation.
And that's Harvey Mollich. He's a professor of sociology, Metropolitan Studies at New York University. Wrote a book a couple of years ago with a very distinct title, Toilet, Public Restrooms, and the Politics of Sharing. Samantha Michaels with us as well, copy editor at Mother Jones, and has been reporting on some of these recent bathroom-related legislation. Also, an interesting short history of the bathroom or bathroom use. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Samantha, going back to that short history that you wrote in Mother Jones, it is interesting to remember that not so long ago, a public bathroom for women was considered a kind of a shocking idea. How come?
Yes, that's right. If you look back to the Victorian era in England, when they started rolling out public bathrooms, at that time they were only available for men, and women had to petition authorities trying to get access to bathrooms. And what I was seeing in my research was, in some ways, it was an attempt to protect women and also to kind of maintain the separate spheres, the separate gender spheres.
Well, and I'm also thinking, Harvey, about it wasn't so long ago, because there weren't that many women in the U.S. Congress. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that the female members of the House and the Senate got their very own bathroom.
Yes,
exactly.
Go ahead, Harvey, and then Samantha, I'll get you in on that as well. Harvey, go ahead.
Yeah, as the social structure changes and women enter into new spheres, including, by the way, things like factory work, then the bathrooms got to follow. It's always sort of it's one step behind in the process, always playing catch up. So, I mean, the larger picture is the social reality. Like, for example, the existence of gay people, the existence of transgender. All this is chasing after the hardware, and then we get these kinds of tensions that we can see.
Samantha, you want to add to that, and we'll get some folks in on the conversation.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that it was quite interesting. I mean, before the female House members had access to their own bathrooms, they were actually sharing bathrooms with tourists in Statuary Hall.
Just to sort of underscore this, frankly, very interesting history there. Also, opponents of the ERA, Samantha, said that if the Equal Rights Amendment was passed, it would lead or could lead to co-ed bathrooms.
Yes, that's right. in the 1970s, opponents of the ERA were raising these fears that if it were ratified, it would lead to co-ed bathrooms. And they used very racialized language as well at times. On some of their opposition flyers, they said things like, "Do we really want the sexes to be fully integrated like the races?" Kind of referring back to the civil rights movement and the integration of bathrooms and the ending of Jim Crow laws.
Let me get a couple of callers in. We've got, looks like, William from Marlton, New Jersey. Hi, William. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
A possible easy solution, I guess, to this whole issue is why not just build a third bathroom inside educational institutions, schools, and public places, and simply designate it as gender neutral, or to use an old school term, unisex. what do you think? I'll take my answer off the air.
Fair enough. Thanks for calling in, William. Harvey, you want to take that?
I think that points in a good direction. If you have a third one that's separate, it's a bit probably stigmatizing. That would be the concern with that. But in general, if we just got rid of it, if we just ended the great binary, you would have solved the problems for transgender people. You would also, by the way, dramatically increase efficiency. And eliminate the line at the women's room. There are other ways to do that, too. But also make things more efficient, as, for example, when there's a public event. If it's a boxing match, it's going to be predominantly male. And if it's a flower show, it's going to be predominantly female.
Now, be careful. You're going down some gender stereotypes there. But go ahead, Harvey.
I do it knowingly. To the degree to which what I just said is true, it means that you have a physical inefficiency in the use of a public facility. The same with urinals. Urinals are, I like to say, God's gift to public restrooms because they are extremely efficient, both in terms of water use and moving people through. So it would be a really good idea if we could just not worry about these, and that's a very radical idea.
Well, it is.
Well,
you mentioned getting rid of the binary, and by that you mean the designation that there are men and women rather than this kind of spectrum of genders or sexual identity.
Yes, exactly, and also that, and as opposed to emphasizing the need of what people have to want to come across, like, I want to use a toilet versus I want to use a urinal, and have the facility segregated in that way as opposed to the kind of human being that's using it.
That requires a big investment in public bathroom infrastructure, does it not, though, Harvey?
It gradually would do that, but you would move into it with new construction immediately. In some cases, you just need to break through a doorway between the adjacent men's and women's rooms. It would be a case-by-case solution.
Samantha, is that the fix, do you think? Just sort of getting rid of the binary designation?
That's a really interesting idea, and I could see that being one possible solution. Another possible solution is, without the, investment in infrastructure, is just really allowing people to use whichever bathrooms they feel most comfortable in, whichever one that they identify with. And one of the callers had brought up the idea of creating a separate unisex bathroom that anyone could use.
Right.
And Harvey's right critics of that idea say that it could be stigmatizing and for transgender people to have to use those separate bathrooms. But what you could do is you could just have those other bathrooms available to anybody. You could allow transgender students to use the multi-stall public bathrooms of their choice. And anybody who doesn't feel comfortable with that could could have this other option of a unisex bathroom with a bit more privacy. So that's another idea.
Let me read a tweet from Rich. I'll toss this to you, Samantha. He says, are transgender Americans considered a protected class? And how do they plan on checking birth certificates? This would be in North Carolina. And as Matt Apuzzo was telling us, there might be some legal question about whether they are or aren't a protected class. But do you want to jump in on that, Samantha?
Sure. This law in North Carolina, basically the bathroom provision of the law, police officers have said that they really won't be able to enforce it. I called up a bunch of police departments in North Carolina after the law passed, and I asked them what they would be doing and if they would be checking birth certificates. And they said that they didn't have the resources to do so. Some of them kind of laughed at the suggestion and said that they wouldn't be sending police officers to bathrooms like guards there, but that they would be responding to any kind of complaint that they received from anyone who was using the bathroom.
About a minute before our second break here, back to you, Samantha. What's interesting is that this bill in North Carolina was pretty much passed within, about 24 hours?
Yes, it was passed in a special session, and I believe it went through both the state house and the state senate in less than 10 hours, and it was signed by the governor that same night.
What was the hurry, do you think?
I'm not quite sure. I think that in some ways it was done kind of secretively. The bill wasn't made public, and so like Democratic lawmakers, I think, weren't able to read it until the very last minute, and I think some of them actually walked out as protest. So it could have been, just an effort to get it passed. I'm not quite sure what the reason was.
Well, let's take another very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about bathrooms in this hour of Radio Times, a very interesting history of civil rights in bathrooms over the decades, sometimes even centuries. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A lot of people want to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Just a recap here. Last Friday, the Obama administration issued a sweeping directive telling public schools that they must let transgender students use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. Now, this comes just a month or two after North Carolina passed a bill that states that people must use the bathroom that corresponds to the sex on their birth certificate. We've been talking about the battle over bathrooms with Harvey Mollich, author of Toilet, Public Restrooms and the Politics of Sharing, and Samantha Michaels, who's been writing about this for Mother Jones. Let me get Chris from Bala Cynwyd to join the conversation. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm sorry. I was just putting my phone in off headset. Thank you for taking my call.
You're
I
welcome.
Wanted to ask you something. No matter where you fall on the topic, what your position is, it seems to me that the Obama administration was a little short-sighted to bring this up now in an election year, where there's a lot of nervousness about a certain Republican taking office, and it just makes you wonder if this is yet another polarizing element to throw in there. Now, why not wait till next year?
Well, obviously we can't directly answer that, Chris, because we'd have to ask the Obama administration themselves.
Well, I'm sure, but I'm just kind of throwing it out.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Let me see what Harvey Mollich has to say. Harvey, have you thought about that?
I think it could go either way. I haven't thought too much about it, and I also don't know what the candidate is going to, the Republican candidate is going to say or do, because he's been a little bit unpredictable on these matters in his excesses when he's agitated, and also in a show of good sense that also sometimes occurs. And the idea of let people just handle this in the kind of discreet way that we talked about earlier in the program, let it be.
Well, in fact, Samantha, at least a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump seemed to think that North Carolina, the House bill, North Carolina, about bathrooms was unnecessary and it wouldn't be something he would use at his building or in his buildings.
Yeah. Shortly after the bill passed, in one of his earlier interviews, Donald Trump made a comment saying that that he thought that the law was unnecessary and that, you know, just to leave things as they were. Later on, he backtracked after Ted Cruz criticized him for that initial position. Donald Trump backtracked and he said that he thought that the Obama administration was overreaching by trying to dictate how people have access to the bathrooms.
Chris, thanks for the call. Let me get Kent from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Kent, go ahead. You're on the air.
My point is that I don't think people realize how offensive many Americans find it to compare this to a civil rights issue. Segregation and Jim Crow in America was about maintaining a permanent underclass, economic exploitation of people post-slavery, post a time when people's children were sold. I don't see transgender people having to get on a southbound rail car in the back of the train at Union Station. I don't see that their children were ever sold. I don't see them being pushed down to being a permanent economic underclass. Both my maternal grandparents were janitors at the post office. My paternal grandfather was a bellman. That's as high as they got during their entire career.
Well, Kent, no, I think
people should be conscious of this.
No, absolutely. And I think you raise a really important point. And I don't think anyone is doing a direct comparison to what African-Americans, what slaves in this country had to endure. But we heard from the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, talking about this, putting this, frankly, Harvey Mollich, into civil rights terms and the idea of treating people equally. Do you want to respond to what Kent said and anything else that his question raises or his comment raises?
Well, I think the Attorney General had to, because of the nature of her job, find parallels in the law and in constitutional history. So I think that's, from her standpoint, what she was doing. I think, in general, I don't think anyone, I shouldn't say anyone, but I don't think very many people see it as a parallel in a good number of ways to the history of civil rights and the history of slavery. It is the case, however, that for those individuals who are affected, let's say young people, transgender children are headed for transgender status, it is very difficult and there is a very high rate of suicide. So at the individual level, everything is at stake.
Do you want to respond to that, Samantha? And Ken, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, obviously this touches a deeply felt issue.
Yes, you know, I agree with what Harvey was saying and also with some of the caller's comments about how it's not, you know, the exact same thing that we're dealing with here. But there are similarities, certainly, and I think the Attorney General was just trying to get us thinking about this issue in terms of civil rights. And certainly what Harvey was saying is true, that there is a very high suicide rate among transgender people. And, you know, there is also some economic marginalization of transgender people having a harder time sometimes finding a job. And sometimes there can be a lot of pressure to go into sex work. So there are some similarities, but it's not the exact same thing, obviously.
Ken, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me read an email from Paul. Samantha, I'll put this to you. He says, is there any data on assaults or bullying of trans and or gay students in school bathrooms? Have you looked at that?
I haven't done too much reporting on assaults of transgender students in school bathrooms. I have done some reporting that looks at violence against transgender people just in society at large. And over the past year, there has been a dramatic spike in violence against transgender women, especially transgender women of color. Now, I don't know that these are happening in bathrooms so much, but there have been very many murders of transgender women of color over the past year. And so this is definitely a very vulnerable group of people. And I think that there is a fear among transgender people that if they go into the bathroom of their birth sex, where they will stand out because they don't look that way anymore, I think there is a fear that they might get assaulted if they do that.
Harvey, let me go back to you. I'm looking at something that you wrote last year, actually in the Huffington Post. Basically, and before all this got so highly charged and politicized, calling for just much more privacy when it comes to public bathrooms. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So this dilemma of how you provide enough privacy for people to feel comfortable versus the capacity to maintain surveillance is settled in different ways in different countries. And the U.S. is very exceptional. And for people who have traveled to Europe, you run into the fact that the stalls are much more private. Ours have the large amount of open space above and below, very flimsy, tinny partitions, little see-through spaces along the edges. That's the way we've solved it, which is to really create misery for everybody because we want to be able to see what goes on inside if we're so interested or if the authorities are interested. It's a peculiar solution, and so we're all lessened by it. I think we're all damaged by it, and so before you get to the kinds of issues we've been discussing, there's a matter of common decency. The solution would be to improve our restrooms dramatically in terms of ventilation, in terms of insulation of noise, affordances to acknowledge that, in fact, it's part of life. We have a responsibility to let people to ease that those difficulties.
Making public bathrooms just much more private, from what you're saying, Harvey.
Much more private and also just much more pleasant. It's just a mean and difficult experience. And part of that is because it's a taboo subject. So to talk about it, as we're doing right now, is itself almost a deviant act. And for politicians to come forward with something like I've talked about is difficult. Even I happen to have been on many building committees for public buildings, working with architects and so forth, and very little attention is given to these kinds of things that we're now talking about, like what's the stall going to be made out of? Hmm. What will the sound insulation be like? None of this gets even 10 seconds of conversation. And the lowest person on the totem pole of the architect's office is the typical person who is then assigned the task of making these decisions.
Let me read us a couple of comments here. A Facebook comment from Jay. He says the LGBT community was caught flat-footed post-gay marriage, and this bathroom is a perfect example. Instead of patting ourselves on the back, we should be doing what has worked in the past, working to change hearts and minds and ensuring the laws don't discriminate. Then we have an email from Mary. Please stop promoting LGBT issues. They are minority, do not need to change our entire culture. Leave our bathrooms alone and also keep the school curriculum free of LGBT content. Let parents teach their own children. An email from Gerald. He says, my Pennsylvania driver's license and official government document states sex male. What if I prefer to use a woman's bathroom? Do some PA driver's licenses indicate more than two sexes? Should that identity now be changed to protect this new class of transgender? Just to get a feel for how people are responding to this issue. Let me get Jeanette from Newtown Square to join us. Jeanette, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sure. My
question is about bathroom usage for disabled adults who need assistance from their caregivers, and also families needing changing places for their, let's say, fathers for their daughters or mothers for their sons. Will this law affect access for disabled people? And if so, is that a possible challenge in lieu of, I guess, people's willingness to get on the transgender equality?
Right. And Jeanette, you're talking about the law in North Carolina?
Yeah, I'm talking about the law in North Carolina. And I'm also talking from personal experience of just using family bathrooms in our local gym. And, you know, like not wanting to give that up.
Sure. No, I hear you.
To be able to help my son. Great.
Well, that's an interesting point, Samantha, which is if a dad has a little girl and needs to change her diapers, does he go, you know, which bathroom does he use? And also, Jeanette, raising the question about a disabled person and perhaps their caretaker. Are we getting lost in the weeds here, or is this part of a larger conversation?
I don't think that we're getting lost in the weeds. I do think that these are important questions to be asking. And in fact, after North Carolina's law passed, I received emails from a number of people with those same questions asking about whether they would be able to take their disabled husband into the bathroom to help him. And so, yeah, these are important questions to be asking. I'm actually not sure you know, what the answer is in North Carolina. The law was passed very quickly, and a lot of critics say that lawmakers were not considering these types of things when passing the law and that they didn't think about it carefully enough.
Jeanette, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Here's an email from Patty. She says, I advocate increased privacy in locker rooms in general. We haven't really talked about that. Children are very sensitive to peer judgment, and the shower room creates a vulnerable situation for children. Personally, I came from India, and I was naturally modest, so I was very uncomfortable in the locker room in high school. Harvey, you've been talking about more privacy. You want to respond to that comment from our listener?
Yes, and first of all, that a good sense is a good remedy. And Samantha pointing out that the police were reluctant to step in, I think that's an indicator of the fact that they're not needed, and no matter what the law is, they won't be there because these problems are solved every day vastly. And this idea that some people are more modest than other people, that there are possible acts of violence that go on, especially in boys' rooms, locker rooms, as well as restrooms. And people who run institutions, teachers and principals and administrators have to just be able to deal with these problems and issues in a sensible, compassionate, ad hoc way. And creating laws, if anything, merely get in the way and invite a stereotype and kind of brittle, harsh reactions that don't make any sense in terms of the real world. And a whole lot of goodwill that's actually there.
Samantha, we're almost out of time here. In your short history of bathrooms and toilets, take us back to Rome, you know, Rome 2,000 years ago.
Yes, that's right. So in ancient Rome, we didn't have this same kind of binary of the sexes when it came to public bathrooms. They had big open latrines that could accommodate dozens of people at once, up to 80 people at once, I think. And people of all ages, men and women, would use these outdoor latrines at the same time, and they would be sitting side by side, no stalls between them, so everybody could see everybody else while going to the bathroom. There was no privacy like we know today. So it's just an indication of how much things can change in terms of what we think is acceptable.
Well, Samantha Michaels, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And Harvey Mullich, thank you for joining us as well.
Sure, a pleasure.
And you're welcome. And we began our conversation with Matt Apuzzo. Lots of people wanting to join the conversation. We can carry it on, or you can carry it on. Go to our Facebook page at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.